Hello, this is Rachel Babin from Oncology News Australia, proud producers of the Oncology Journal Club podcast. This week, we have another great episode for you in our usual format. Hans Prenham talks us through a topical BRAF inhibitor therapy. Craig Underhill tackles another big guidelines paper full of practical information and analysis. And our host, Eva Segaloff, debunks an urban myth on the abscopal effect. As ever, the links to all of the papers discussed today are available in the notes on our website. For regular news and podcast updates, subscribe to the Oncology newsletter on oncologynews.com.au. It's free and it's a great way to support the OJC. This is Rachel Babin and this is the Oncology Podcast.
We're back. G'day, g'day, g'day. What have you been doing, Hans? I see your hips wiggling to Eurovision. Did you vote for the UK?
Actually, I have to admit that I didn't watch. I just heard that some strange guy from Italy won it. It was a bit weird, but I like rock music, so I'm a big fan of the song, actually. But maybe let's focus on the science, because I read a lot of interesting articles this week.
Oh, yes. Actually, you're serious, yeah. Aren't you? Oh, great.
Yeah, indeed.
Interesting article.
Oh, I think Eurovision's much more interesting than some of the articles you've put up for this show, Hans. Can you believe another week's gone by? It just seems like 5 minutes ago we were recording the last episode.
It was 5 minutes. We were recording two in a row. Hans, your paper. Let's go.
Actually, you won't believe it, but I have it on email. So there was a paper published now, and this was actually the same idea that I had, let's say, around 5 years ago. And I will explain to you what it is. It's published in Cancer Discovery.
Hang on. I presume you didn't publish it.
I didn't publish, and I will explain you why. So at that time, we had serious problems with skin toxicities from EGFR inhibitors. Everybody knows this. Yeah, one of my ideas was let's make some kind of topical cream that inhibits BRAF. And then I discussed with a lot of scientists, but the main problem is I couldn't find any pharmacist to make this cream and to try to test it out in a phase one trial. So I was so happy to see this paper published in May in Cancer Discovery, where they want to reduce skin tox from EGFR inhibitors with topical BRAF inhibitor cream. Why does it work? Because as you know, BRAF inhibitors, they are known to paradoxically activate the MAPK downstream of EGFR in skin cells. And actually, when you have studies where they combine anti-EGFR with systemic anti-BRAF, we do this now thanks to the Beacon study, for example, in BRAF-V600 mutated colon, then you see they have less skin tox. So it makes sense. And they tested the hypothesis that topical therapy with BRAF inhibition could improve skin toxicity. And how does it work? It would reverse the phospho-ERK inhibition through this then paradoxical MAPK activation in skin cells that are, of course, BRAF wild type, in contrast with the tumor that is BRAF mutated sometimes. So actually, to make a long story short, by giving it topical, it doesn't interfere with the anti-cancer treatment and also with other toxicities that systemic BRAF inhibition gives. They only tested 10 patients, but it was a phase one trial. Patients were treated with anti-EGFR, developed grade 1 or 2 skin rash, and they saw that indeed the acneiform rash improved in most patients and that the cream was well tolerated. Just one comment, beware. There is a concentration-dependent modulation of phospho-ERK. So you have to keep in mind that the concentration is very important. So there is a window. If you have too low concentrations, it gives no activation of the MAPK pathway, so then you still have the skin tox. If you give it too high, it gives inhibition, so then also not good. So they found right dose to be used, and that also worked. So that's why I was so happy to see this paper a couple of years, 5 years after my idea popped up, and I couldn't do it.
I'm so happy that an idea that you had came to fruition in a journal paper. Well done.
Just next time you might try and do it.
Do it myself, yeah.
So maybe we should have a competition. What would you call the cream if you had the branding for it?
The cream?
Well, it was a cream.
BRAF cream?
Oh, that's inventive. Okay, that can be homework for next time. BRAF cream. God. Lucky you didn't have the idea.
What about Toxo rub?
Yep, there's some good ideas. And if any listeners want to send in an idea, we might even interview you.
So, Eva, which amazing paper did you select this week for the main paper session?
Well, I can't say it was something that I had the idea about 5 years ago, Hans. But I thought this was interesting. It's actually an editorial. The accompanying paper was the randomized phase two trial of Nevo with stereotactic body radiotherapy versus nivolumab alone in metastatic head and neck squamous cell cancer. And why I like the editorial is that it was entitled Time to Debunk an Urban Myth, the abscopal effect, in inverted commas, with radiation and anti-PD-1. So I love urban myth busters, so it immediately drew my attention. So the word abscopal, Craig, true or false, comes from the Latin ab, meaning away from, and scopus, meaning target.
Sounds like Greek to me.
No, 50%, you got it wrong. 50% chance and you got it wrong. Comes from the Latin, and it was coined in 1953. And at the time, it specifically referred to the effects of ionizing radiation outside of the actual tumor volume being irradiated. And it's been presumed to be mediated through the immune system. And now the term abscopal effect is surrogate for enhancement or induction of systemic immune effects. Although the term's also being used not just with radiation, but other local therapies like cryotherapy, radiofrequency ablation, or intertumoral medications. So as you know, we've been hearing for a long time from our radiation oncology colleagues that they have systemic effects and it's this magic abscopal effect. So they're just as important as us because they really do treat the whole body. We know that's not true. They just treat the little bit in the square. But here's a trial that I'm tongue-in-cheek there, audience.
I'm disappointed. I'm really disappointed because I love writing referral letters to radiation oncology. Said this is in case of the, with the CC to the GP, in case of the abscopal effect, and sound like I'm clever.
Well, it does, but you'll have to quote this editorial that says this trial provides the clearest evidence so far that contrary to the widely held perception in the field, the abscopal effect remains exceedingly rare and is not clinically relevant when using anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 therapies and SBRT for head and neck cancer, at least when you apply it to a single lesion. So there are still some questions about if we should use something like SBRT with oligometastatic disease to really zap all the little bits and whether that confers some advantage. But it's a great editorial. I think you'll have to stop writing the abscopal effect, Craig, and then how will the GPs know how smart you are?
I know, that's it. My career's finished, but anyway.
Look, there were some interesting hypotheses that maybe it is more important if you've got something like a virally induced cancer, so an HPV-related head and neck versus non-HPV. So it might live on a little bit longer, the good old abscopal effect. Over to you, Craig. What's your main paper?
Well, I again, guideline, and we'd like to do things that are sort of practical for our audience, but this was a guideline from the JCO. It's an ASCO guideline, neoadjuvant chemotherapy, endocrine therapy and targeted therapy for breast cancer, published in May 2021. So I picked this because this was referred to in our breast MDT recently, and there was a little bit of controversy because, like vaccine skeptics, some of our surgeons are sadly remain neoadjuvant skeptics in the breast cancer field. And there was a couple of cases of patients clearly that, according to this guideline, should have been treated with neoadjuvant treatment and they weren't. So don't tell anybody, but, you know, it was a little bit controversial. So this is a systematic review by an ASCO expert panel, 41 articles, which met the eligibility criteria for this guideline, and they basically came up with a series of recommendations for who should be considered for neoadjuvant treatment based on the histology, grade, stage, size, estrogen, progesterone, and epidermal growth factor receptor, HER2 expression, to guide the decision. There was insufficient evidence at this stage that other markers, biomarkers, should be useful for guiding treatment. So really just the stage, grade, ER, PR, and HER2. So they basically said that any triple negative breast cancers bigger than a T1C, regardless of the node status, should be considered for neoadjuvant treatment. Now, unfortunately, these patients relapse systemically, and early use of systemic treatment makes sense in those patients. And then for patients with hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative disease, with large tumours, you can use hormone therapy to downstage them. And in fact, in elderly patients, even if they're technically operable, it may be appropriate just to treat them with hormones long term. We've all had experience with that. Anyway, an interesting paper, especially I think for the trainees to look at and look at what's evidence-based in this field. Unfortunately, there's no survival benefit or disease-free survival benefit. There were some large studies done in the 90s, probably before some of them were born, which failed to demonstrate that. And now, you know, with modern approaches and supportive care, yeah, I think it would be really difficult to do randomized clinical trials in this space. And I think, I know in Europe, Hans might like to comment, but a lot of centers would be using neoadjuvant therapy routinely. Australia, I think most centers have gone down that pathway as well, but, you know, there's not universal agreement with this approach.
I can jump in there saying our breast cancer oncologists feel too many patients are sent for neoadjuvant because of that lack of survival advantage. So it's funny, isn't it? The breast surgeons seem to be very keen even in the absence of survival advantage, and yet our colorectal or upper GI surgeons around Australia, some are finding it a lot harder to come on board with things like TNT, total neoadjuvant therapy for rectal. What's the European perspective, Hans?
I think we even discussed this in a previous podcast. So we are going more and more towards neoadjuvant. And even the surgeons are convinced now that a lot of patients should receive neoadjuvant therapy.
I had the experience in France, Eva, as you know, I did a sabbatical there and was on a breast cancer unit at the Institut Bourgogne in Bordeaux. I just wanted to say that.
How come your accent's so crappy then?
They're pretty much. Anyone with a palpable breast cancer on presentation was referred to the neoadjuvant clinic and had neoadjuvant approach. It was really only the screen-detected lesions that went straight to surgery, and often that was if they needed a mastectomy, you know, they had immediate reconstruction. That was sort of ahead of the time. They used Ki-67 to help guide decisions, I think, ahead of what we generally did in Australia as well. So it was interesting to get that other perspective on what's done. But basically, if women had a palpable tumour, they got treatment up front.
I think you spent most of your sabbatical in the vineyards, didn't you? In Bordeaux.
We had a bit of fun while we were there.
Not like Hans on his sabbatical.
So I selected two short bios this week. The first one is, and this is an interesting one, it's a phase 2 study published in GCO online May 10th. And it's a study of maintenance rucaparib in platinum-sensitive pancreatic cancer. As you know, olaparib is approved as a maintenance in pancreatic cancer with germline BRCA. So this is important, germline BRCA. And this study assessed the role of another PARP inhibitor called rucaparib as a maintenance, a bit the same idea in 42 patients. The median overall survival was 23 months, so it's a non-randomized study. It's just a single arm. But I think long survivals with a mean duration of response of 17 months. But what was important in this group is that they also included patients with PALB2 mutations, and the BRCAs could be either germline or somatic. And what we see is that there is also activity in germline pulp B2 and in somatic BRCA 1 and 2. So maybe it doesn't matter that much whether the BRCA is germline or whether it's somatic. And I think that's why this is an interesting paper. The second paper is also something which is important in our daily clinical practice, because this is a study of screening lower endoscopy in patients older than 75. It's published in JAMA Oncology, May 2021, by a group from Boston. It's sometimes I always wonder, okay, we know that screening with endoscopy should start at 50, but what do we do over 75? It's a prospective cohort study, and to make a long story short, the data actually supports continuation of screening after 75 only when you have no significant comorbidity. So if you think that this 75-year-old or 76 will still live very long, then it makes sense to do a further screening.
Lucky for the gastroenterologists, because they were just running out of people to scope.
Abscope.
So whose turn it is for doing some quick bites? Craig, did you select some this week?
I did. So I had some interesting ones. Eva referred to the PROFOUND study in her landmark analysis of study design. I'm not sure which episode it was. It was in the first, was 36, Eva?
No, I think it was 34. But anyway, 34. Listen to them all.
Exactly. Well, that was a segue to say that. So this was olaparib versus cabazitaxel in metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer. So you referred to the PROFOUND study in that as an example of a not well-designed study that had an inferior reference arm. So in that study, it was controversial because they used a switch strategy from enzalutamide to abiraterone following progression, or the other way around, compared to a PARP inhibitor in men with prostate cancer who demonstrated some markers of homologous recombination DNA repair deficiency that might be susceptible to PARP inhibitor, and olaparib was a drug used in that study. So in this study, they did an analysis and they used, I'm not a professor, so I don't understand this. They used frequentist and Bayesian network meta-analysis using the Meta and RJAG packages, respectively, in R version 3.4.2 to analyze.
Hey, Craig.
Yeah.
I just filled in your recommendation to become a professor, so I'm going to revoke it now. I'm going to quote you.
Thanks, Eva. So basically, they did a review of clinical trials of cabazitaxel or PARP inhibitors in patients with metastatic castrate-refractory prostate cancer following abiraterone or enzalutamide, and did this analysis as two studies. And basically, the conclusion was that the benefit associated with olaparib was reduced, eliminated, or inferior in specific subgroups of patients when this switch strategy was compared to a more active standard of care, i.e. cabazitaxel. So it kind of adds weight to your comment and the comment in that paper, Eva, that this PROFOUND study and this switch strategy was maybe an inferior strategy to a standard chemotherapy of cabazitaxel at the time. My other quick bite is sticking to the olaparib theme, is looking at previously treated pancreatic cancer patients with DNA damage repair genetic alterations other than germline BRCA variants, a finding from a two phase two non-randomized clinical trials. And so again, we like to mention some negative studies. So there was limited anti-tumor activity. There were patients with stable disease and quite durable in some of them, but overall, the conclusion was that there was limited anti-tumor activity in these patients with pancreas cancer and BRCA-ness phenotypes other than BRCA genes. And my last quick bite is, Eva, it's a study from Australia, top priorities for health service improvements among Australian oncology patients. So this was a survey of six sites led by a group in Newcastle, Australia. And guess what? the number one health service improvement identified amongst 860 consumers in Australia?
Parking.
Excellent. You go to the top of the class, Professor Segalov. Parking was head and shoulders the number one issue for improvement of cancer centres in Australia. I couldn't believe it. Second was providing up-to-date information on your treatment or your progress. That was number two after parking by a long way. And that wasn't statistically different to all the rest, which was good hospital catering, help to maintain daily activities, information on financial assessment, reduce waiting time for your appointment, help with information on physical symptoms, side effects. So good old parking was the number one issue for cancer services to solve amongst Australian oncology patients. But it is great to see that consumer perspective, which we talked about on the last episode.
Wow, I said that as a joke. I didn't mean to get that right. Amazing, isn't it? Yeah, I think you're right. What we think is important and what consumers think is important, it's not that they don't want good cancer treatment, but if they can't park, they can't come and get their good cancer treatment. How's the parking in Belgium?
I was just going to comment, with us, it's okay, there is parking, but they complain about that it's not free. So often they have to pay for their parking, they have to come quite often, and they always ask, okay, can we not get a free parking card? But in a lot of hospitals, the parking is sometimes not even from the hospital, so it's so often a private company. So that's why we can't offer them free parking cards. So the cost is sometimes an issue here.
Actually, hospitals in Australia also outsource their car parking. And during the pandemic, that's been a major reduction in their income because they take a big cut with the private companies. So hospitals have actually had a cut in income because of reduced car parking from staff and patients. Multifactorial. Who wants to hear my quick bites?
Oh, yeah. Eva, what have you got for us?
Ah, well, continuing the segues, so last episode Hans told us about Coca-Cola and sweet drinks and increase in young patients with colorectal cancer. So I thought this was interesting. The US Preventative Service Task Force, which is the body that makes all the screening recommendations, have for the very first time reduced the average risk screening commencement age to 45. So down from 50 to 45. They did categorize it as level B, which is moderate certainty that the net benefit is moderate to substantial. So lots of happy tweeters thinking this is really an advance for us to have routine, the recommendation in the US, but it's adhered to or as a standard around the world for those who have screening, it starts at 45. I've got another very quickly adoption of multiple primary endpoints in phase 3 trials of systemic treatments, continuing my theme of good trials. If you want to understand about multiple trial endpoints, this is a systematic review in EJC. Click on the link. And then a network meta-analysis. Okay, Craig, now this is your promotion to associate professor quiz. I've got the panel dialing in, and your question is, what is a network meta-analysis?
I think he's looking it up on Google.
And if you don't get it right, you get demoted to lecturer, or you could go back to being a medical student, actually. So the network meta-analysis is where you get the paper with all the fancy nodes and the joins, like all the little coloured baubles that are all connected in different ways. It's actually in taking individual patient data of meta-analyses and examining all the connections. And this one's of chemotherapy and radiotherapy in locally advanced head and neck cancer. And the one that came up with the best overall survival outcome, the best treatment, was concomitant chemotherapy with hyperfractionated radiotherapy. So network meta-analyses, something we've got to get used to. Maybe we need to do a stats special edition, and then maybe our three listeners will reduce to about one listener, but we'll learn something.
Great idea, Eva.
And so on that note, Craig, have you looked up the answer yet?
I have. You described it very well, Eva. I'll let you stay on as prof.
So I did put your major achievement, Craig, in my review as being a co-host of the OJC and that you've influenced oncology. You're an oncology educator with global influence.
Big shout out to Steve Vogel in New York.
And that segues nicely into ASCO. So don't miss our ASCO specials. Lots of more interesting stuff all the time on OJC. It's goodbye to you, Hans.
Bye, Eva.
Enjoy your new racing bike.
I will.
And goodbye to you, Craig. Good luck.
Thanks, Eva.
Medical student.
Here I am.
Thanks, Rach. Thanks, team. See you next time. Bye for now. Oh, hang on. I've got a call. It might be about my shopping order. I better just take it.
Hello? Hello? Is that the Oncology Podcast?
Yes. Oh, we got a phone call, everyone.
This is Merv from New Zealand, and I just wanted to have a chat to you about what I've been hearing on your show. I'm particularly concerned about how you keep saying that Australia does stuff better than New Zealand when everybody knows that's just not true.
Hang on. Hans and Craig, are we a talkback podcast? Merv? Does anyone know Merv from New Zealand? Hang on, the number's familiar. It's CJ. CJ, is that you?
Oh, well, yes. Okay.
CJ, you're our one New Zealand listener, so you're welcome on the podcast.
Well, look, I've been listening to this podcast now for the last 6 weeks, and I've got to say my blood pressure's been going up, really. And this one has just taken it a little bit too far. I mean, Eva, everyone knows that we have more bowel cancer in New Zealand than Australia, so we do that better than you. We know that we have fewer drugs in New Zealand, so we spend less, which is more efficient, which means we're better than you. And now, again, you're talking about an issue which is very important in New Zealanders' hearts around equity in cancer, and you're making out like you guys are leading at this too. I mean, it's bordering on the appropriation, and we need to have a talk.
Well, look, I agree, and you're better at COVID, or you're better at getting in the New England Journal with your eradication of COVID.
Yeah. No, we're doing okay.
No, CJ, in all seriousness, I will concede that you are doing better with your Indigenous cancer and policy outcomes than Australia, because we're really pretty bad.
Well, look, I wouldn't want to comment on the situation in Australia particularly, Eva, and I think certainly in New Zealand, the situation with Māori in New Zealand is actually still a source of national consternation and shame. We have had a long legacy of inequitable outcomes where Māori are more likely to get cancer and almost twice as likely to die from cancer once diagnosed. But I think there is an increasing recognition of that equity gap, and slowly but surely steps are being taken to address that. Let me give you some examples. We know that in Indigenous populations internationally, screening programs are targeted towards the dominant majority through the fact of, you know, the style of invitation, confidence in healthcare, the fact the healthcare system looks like, the people who are being offered to, and the like. And so in New Zealand, our medical school has had a policy of being a mirror on society, and that means that we wanted to graduate as many Māori New Zealanders and non-Māori New Zealanders. Well, no, we don't let too many sheep into our medical school. We have the odd Aussie who comes across, but, you know, call them what you like. And so I think that's been really important. And also with cancer, we are starting to report outcomes by ethnicity regularly in our routine data sets and having programs which are looking to create that, to reduce that equity gap. We are far from there, but the steps are to acknowledge it, to partner, to have senior Māori leadership. And in fact, our national cancer agency called Te Aho o Te Kahu has got 50% Māori leadership in the board, which is huge. That's what partnership is starting to look like. And our relationship with the National Māori Cancer Leadership Group, Hei Ahuru Mōwai, led to the naming of our agency, Te Aho o Te Kahu. And that partnership between colonial New Zealand and Indigenous Māori is starting to look more like a partnership. And that's the direction we want to go.
How long do you think it will take to have an impact on your cancer outcomes?
Well, too long, of course. I mean, I think anything other than immediate is too long. But I think that we are already starting to see some improvements. And that shows that the problem of inequitable outcomes is not insoluble. And we've seen over the course of the last 15 years, the gap in survival in bowel cancer in particular between Māori and non-Māori reducing. So around 10, 15 years ago, the survival gap was perhaps 20 to 30%. It's now reducing significantly, and it's getting harder to detect in the routine data sets. That's not to say the work is done, but it's to say that a focused approach over the course of the last 10 to 15 years does make a difference. Once people are diagnosed with cancer, outcomes in breast cancer, once diagnosed through the screening program, outcomes for Māori and non-Māori are identical. So that is extraordinarily good in terms of an outcome. Now, Māori are still diagnosed at later stage and still have lower engagement with the screening program because the screening program hasn't yet achieved success in that metric. So there is still work to be done, but it shows that we have progressed in certain areas, it's making an impact, which is fantastic.
For oncology, is there particular training, cultural sensitivity? Is there good awareness of non-Māori about the issues and the approach, the psychosocial, the models of care?
That varies broadly around the country. We don't have homogenous population distribution. You know, Auckland, Northland, for example, have a much higher Māori and Pacifica population than we do here in the Deep South. And so, of course, the approach is very different in those two areas. I think one of the crucial things in general, though, is role modelling, right? You know, you have to have role models and you have to have people in the profession. So getting Māori trainees through med school into leadership roles, into positions, this takes a generation to come through to that level. And also helping non-Māori understanding issues around implicit bias, institutional racism, having an understanding of obligations under our founding document, the Treaty of Waitangi, and people wanting to address the issues is important. I mean, I've heard for a long time, you know, denial of the issue on committees or groups I've sat in, and that's starting to change, and there is a willingness to engage with that. Long way to go, long way to go. We are not a model of perfection by any stretch, and the outcomes are still poorer, but we're moving in a direction which I think will lead us somewhere positive.
So you New Zealanders are really pretty nice and laid back, and, you know, you just roll along. You don't get too upset about these things, do you?
Well, you know, when you've got such a beautiful country, it's hard to get riled up about too much. But I think the cancer outcomes for Māori compared to non-Māori are something worth getting riled up about. And certainly Māori are saying this has gone on too long and we have to do something about this. At the present time, there is a claim with the Waitangi Tribunal, which is about ensuring that the Treaty of Waitangi is honoured, the founding document between the Crown and Indigenous Māori. And the claim is that the poor outcomes for cancer for Māori compared to non-Māori is an act of colonial oppression and that it is a racist outcome. And I have to say, I think I agree with that. I think that, you know, systemic racism is the programs you choose to run. It's whether you choose to run bowel cancer screening ahead of lung cancer screening. It's whether you choose to look at the social determinants of health. It's whether you choose to address access issues. It's about where you put your cancer hospitals in relation to your population. It's about the types of rotations you expect your trainees to go on. It's about the cultural competency training. All of those things are active decisions that institutions make or fail to make that lead to the entrenchment or the address or having these issues addressed. And the claim is being hurt. I think that there will be a very strong finding on that. And I think that we already have a moral obligation to address this. This will, I think, be a legal obligation to address this as well. I think one of the great things about Australia and New Zealand is we've got a real big brother, little brother thing going on here, right? You know, we look across the ditch and we often point to the fact that your five-year survival rates for certain cancers are way ahead of ours. And then we look at some of the things that we do and you do and we go, well, there's no way in heck we'd ever want to do that. So we quite like comparing ourselves to you. But I think also there are still some things that Australia could learn from New Zealand too. And it is worth looking the other way from time to time. There are a couple of things I think we do okay. And I think that that partnership that we have, the way in which Australia always includes New Zealand in the intergroup collaborative groups, the way in which we communicate with our trainees, the way we share our training programs, the way you always generously ensure that New Zealanders are included in your invitations for jobs and making sure that they have the opportunity to come and train in your hospitals. That relationship is so valuable, and we really, really do treasure that between the two countries. You know, little brother can occasionally get a little bit prickly and think we're being forgotten about and make a wee bit more noise, but I think that's okay. You'll just put us back in our place.
Hey, Hans, these New Zealanders sound pretty good, don't they? A long way ahead, but don't tell Merv. Merv, thanks for joining us today. Feel free to call in anytime, any issue at the Oncology Journal Club.
Yeah, well, I think someone needs to keep you honest either. So I think I will call back. I'll be listening closely. And anytime I think you're getting a bit too big for your boots, I'll give you a bell.
Well, I do have one job for you, CJ.
Go on.
Well, Hans has managed to get 9 listeners in Belgium over the lifetime of the podcast.
How many of the 9 listeners are Hans's mum?
Yeah, I think all 9. So if you can get your mum to listen 10 times, you've got a job.
Yeah, well, I've got 4 email accounts, so that's a good start.
Yeah, none of them work, CJ. Thanks very much, CJ.
All right, Eva. Thanks for having us on.
Love your work. And in all seriousness, Australia has a lot to learn from New Zealand about managing Indigenous cancer. As you heard from CJ, they've still got a long way to go, but we are, I think, a log scale behind, and I hope we catch up very quickly. It's been wonderful having CJ ring in with his passion and his knowledge, and we look forward to having some more Merv calls in future episodes.
You've been listening to the Oncology Podcast. If you enjoyed today's edition and would like to subscribe, head over to our website, oncologynews.com.au, and sign up to our newsletter. Thanks for listening.